The statement that's up there, who do you say I am, is probably the most important question that you're going to have to answer. And the more I looked at this, the more I came to the conclusion that it's probably the question we ought to ask our neighbors. Don't ask them what church they go to. Ask them, who is Jesus? You might get some very interesting answers. Is this on? Okay. Talked to an individual the other day, and I asked him. And he says, well, I don't believe Jesus is God. Well, that's an interesting place to start. Wouldn't do me any good to ask, what church do you go to? So, who is Jesus? H.G. Wells, famous historian, says, I'm not a believer, but I must confess, as a historian, this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably, get that word out today, the very center of history. Jesus Christ easily the most dominant figure in all of history. Why would anyone say this about a backwater Galilean? He's a non-believer, but he's come to the conclusion that Jesus is the most important person in history. Who is he? That's the question. And that's the question you ought to ask your neighbor, ask your friend. Barna did some research, and I'm kind of out of sync here, but that's okay. We'll get the video here in a minute. And the CEO, David Kinneman, wrote an article in Outreach Magazine using the data. He's the CEO of Barna. In that research, he said 71%, and these are of Americans, say they have a positive view of Jesus. They connect him with words like kindness, forgiveness, compassion. Everybody likes those terms. But then they asked a different question. They ask people if they affirm these four statements. That you believe that Jesus lived on the earth. That Jesus was entirely human and fully God. They asked, do you have a personal commitment? They didn't define what commitment was, but a personal commitment to Jesus. And if they believe that Jesus would return to the earth one day. When they asked, do you believe these four things? The number dropped to 35% of American adults that believed these four statements. Now, he points out that's roughly 90 million people, adults. That sounds pretty good until I looked up what the population of the United States is. The population is 340 million. So you've got this group of 35% that are committed. That's how he labels it. Then he has another category. He labels them as skeptics. 26% of the U.S. falls in this category. And at least one of these things is true, that they are uncertain that Jesus ever lived on the earth. Or Jesus is just a myth, or just a man. Or Jesus is not God. Or I'm not even sure there is a God that exists. 26% of the American public fall in that category. That's kind of a scary thing to think about. Maybe the scariest is this last group. 39% are stuck somewhere between the committed and the skeptic. In other words, they're not sure what they believe. So the question comes, who is Jesus? It's the same question today as Jesus is asking his disciples. Let's go ahead and run the little clip.
Who do people say the Son of Man is?
Some say you are Elijah, the one who preaches repentance.
Others say Jeremiah, because he was rejected by the leaders of his time.
And still others say one of the prophets, those that spoke on God's behalf.
Some say John the Baptizer,
which obviously isn't true.
Okay, well, that's everyone else. But who do you say that I am?
Who do you say I am? America today is stuck in the same position. You notice when they ask, he says, well, some say you're a prophet. Maybe Elijah or Jeremiah. And he said, or maybe John the Baptist. That's what Herod was afraid of. What do people today believe? They're not sure. Neither were they. What I'm going to do today is we're going to go through, and I just chose the miracles, to see who Jesus is. Now, there's lots of layers that you could do this with. You could look at his teaching. And the more I looked at this, the more stuff there was to work with. And I told Nancy there's 37 miracles, some say 41, and there's probably more than that. And Nancy said, you're not going to do them all, are you? No, we're not. I was also reminded that nobody complains about a short sermon. I can't guarantee that. But there's 37 miracles at least. And I've picked some that is more common. And to do that, you're going to have to use your imagination. So for the first miracle, I've got three guys that they're going to be the servants that you can imagine. From that point on, you have to use your own imagination. And I'm going to have Charles. He's the old guy. So he's kind of in charge of the servants. We've got Phil over here. He's the strong guy. And you got to have a young guy that everybody else can boss around. And so I've got Corbin for that. So you've got three servants. The first miracle is found in the book of John. And it's interesting when you look at the three or the Gospels, they all approach this in a little different way, but they're answering the same question. Matthew starts you out with the genealogy, all of the genealogy of Jesus. Mark, he's short. He starts out with John the Baptist and the baptism of Jesus. And he's pretty direct, because when Jesus is baptized, a voice from heaven and a dove came down, and the voice said, this is my Son in whom I am well pleased. So you know right off what Mark is thinking. Luke, he picks up kind of there, but he backs you up to John the Baptist and his mother, Elizabeth, and brings you forward. John skips all of that. He starts out by saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word is God. All things came into being by Him, and apart from Him, nothing has come into being. And as you read down through there, then he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And John says, and we beheld His glory. In other words, he's saying, and I am an eyewitness to it. Who is Jesus? Well, John starts the miracles with a miracle at a wedding feast. And I still don't know why, but it's an interesting miracle. And Jesus has been invited, and some of his disciples are there. His mother is there. And the wedding party is going along fine. And they run out of wine. And word gets to Mary. And Mary goes to Jesus and says, they're out of wine. But she's basically saying, do something about it. Sounds like a mother. And he says, Mom? It says woman, but it's actually a word of respect, so we might use the word Mom. It's not my time yet. She doesn't take no for an answer, which those of you that have mothers, and I assume you all do, you know what that's like. She doesn't give him a chance to say anything else. She turns to the servants, and that's where you've got to use your imagination. You've got Charles over here, and you got Phil, and you have Corbin. They're the servants. And Mary says, you servants, you go do what Jesus said or says. Mary doesn't give Jesus a choice. So Jesus says, there's 6 water pots here. Charles, I'm going to put you in charge. You make sure the other 2 guys get those pots full. So they fill these water pots up and they bring them to Jesus. And now he says, now take one, dip some water out, and take it to the head waiter. Everybody points at Corbin and says, you get to do the legwork. And so he takes it to the head waiter, the master of ceremonies, and he takes the water, and he tastes it, and he calls the bridegroom over and said, most people serve the best wine first and the poorer stuff at the end. You've saved the best for last. Now, put yourself in Charles's position, or Phil's, or Corbin. You know what's in that pot, or what was. You filled it up. In fact, Charles may have been back there saying, why do I have to go fill these water pots up? And especially when he says, now take it up to the front. And they're saying, it's just water. We put the wine with the water. You know, water's not that great. And now the head waiter is saying, this is the best wine. What do you think? It doesn't use the term here, but I bet you're thinking, isn't that Jesus that just did that? Who is this man? That is John's introduction to Jesus. Now let's move on. You get to use your imagination. I was always accused in school of being a daydreamer. You can daydream today. Put yourself in either the disciples' position or some of the audience, as we just work our way through some of these miracles. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable today because I like things in chronological order. If I can see where everything's going, I'm not doing that today. I'm kind of taking it by topic. So let's work our way through these for just a moment. We have the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus has taught all day. The disciples are getting worried. we can't feed all these people. Send them away. And Jesus says, no, you feed them. And this particular miracle is found in all four of the Gospels. John tells us that there's a little boy that's got his lunch. That's all. That's all they find in 5,000 people. And so they tell Jesus, we got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Jesus says, great, have everybody sit down. And he prays. Then he takes the bread and the fish and starts dividing it up and feeds 5,000 men. They don't even count the women and children. And the text, when you read it, says they ate as much as they wanted. And when it's over, Jesus says, pick up the leftovers. And there's 12 basketfuls. What are you thinking? You just ate. Would you be asking, who is this man? In fact, they begin to say, this must be the prophet who is to come into the world. And they wanted to, by force, take him and make him king. Who is he? Now, Jesus wasn't in favor of that at all, of course. And you see that he goes off into the countryside for a while. But the question is, who is he? Who can turn water into wine and feed 5,000 people, men, with 5 loaves and 2 fish? Who is he? Now let's go to the Sea of Galilee. They spent a lot of time down there because they were fishermen. I'm not going to get into the fishing stories. But I want to look at the storms. And there's 2 incidents that I want to look at. One of them, they go down and they get in the boat. They're all tired. Jesus goes to the front of the boat, lays down and goes to sleep. And while he's asleep, the Sea of Galilee, it's known for its storms. A storm brews, and it's windy, the waves are big, and the disciples are scared. And they wake Jesus up and says, aren't you worried that we're going to die? Seems like a pretty valid question. And Jesus says, where's your faith? And he stands up. And he commands the wind and the sea to be calm. And then it looks like Lake Uchi on a calm day. What would you be thinking if you're one of those disciples? Verse 27 of Matthew, the 8th chapter, says, the men marveled and ask, what kind of man is this that the wind and the waves obey? He turns water into wine. He feeds the 5,000. And now the storms obey him. Who is he? Now, if we go back for just a moment, I have to think a little bit chronologically. You fed the 5,000, and Jesus sends the disciples back to the sea, get in the boat, go to the other side. Jesus isn't with them. And if you read part of the text, one of them says that the disciples had kind of gotten a hard heart. They didn't pick up what this feeding of the 5,000 and all was about. Maybe they got caught up in counting fish. I don't know. Counting leftovers. But But they're in the boat. And they see something or someone walking on the water. And it scares them. Would you be scared? Put yourself there. That's not normal. And Jesus calls out to him and says, "Don't be afraid, it's me." And Matthew, in his telling of the event, tells us that Peter, of course we know who Peter is, he's always the one that's got to open his mouth first or do something first. He says, "If that's really you, command me to come out and walk on, you know, come to you." And Jesus says, "Come on out." Now, picture yourself sitting there in the boat. And here's Peter, sticking his feet over the side. Maybe he's touching the water with his feet. And he stands up and he doesn't sink. That's not normal. And he starts walking towards Jesus. But then the text tells you he started looking from side to side and he lost his focus. It wasn't on Jesus anymore and he began to sink. And he cries out, "Lord, help me." And of course Jesus does and asks him about his faith. And they get back to the boat, and here's what's interesting. Because it's a place where I've never really noticed before. But when they get back in the boat, it says, those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "You are certainly God's son." A lot of times we overlook that little piece. But they're starting to get the picture. Their hearts were hard. Now they get it. You are God's son. Did an angel ever allow anybody to worship them? Did a prophet? There's nothing here that says Jesus didn't allow it. It says they worshiped him. Who is this man? So we see Jesus here, all these early miracles. He had control over the physical world. He could turn water into wine. He could feed the 5,000. He could control the seas. He could walk on the water. The next grouping is you see, maybe I'll use that later. I'm getting ahead of myself in my head here. The next grouping is he had power over demons. And looking that up, one person said there's over 55 times. Well, I don't know if that's right or not, and I sure wasn't going to count them. But there's more times where Jesus dealt with demons than I realized. The one that I remember, and the one I think is very interesting, is the demon-possessed man on the east side of the Galilee. And I can't pronounce the name. I was going to get that this morning or say it, but I can't remember. But it's on the east side. It's the area of Galilee that is populated primarily by Gentiles. And they've gone over to that side of the lake. And when they get there, they're met with a demon-possessed man. He lives in the tombs. He's naked. Everybody's is afraid of him. And Jesus asked, "What's your name?" And they said, "We are legion because we're many." And they say, "Why are you here? It's not time yet for us to be punished." This is my paraphrase, remember. And then they say, send us over to the pigs over here. They didn't want to go to the judgment, I suppose. And Jesus said, okay, go to the pigs. Then the pigs stampede into the lake and drown. Now that scares the herdsmen. And they run to town. And they tell the town what's happened. So the townspeople come out to see. They get there, they see their pigs down in the lake drowned. But more importantly, they see this demon-possessed man now perfectly sane, dressed, and sitting at the feet of Jesus. And it scares them. So in the first group, you see people that are willing to commit and follow, or at least there are some. They love him. This particular place, you see people that are afraid of him. He just got rid of 3,000 demons. That's what a legion is. And the man is perfectly sane and sitting at the feet of Jesus. And they say, go away. Leave our area, because it scares them. The man, though, he has a completely different desire. His desire is to go with Jesus. He's a Gentile. And Jesus said, no, go back to your community and you tell them what's happened to you. That's to the Gentiles in the area. A lot of times he said, don't say anything. You didn't need a big crowd. But in this case, he says, tell your friends. Again, the question is, who is Jesus? We're starting to get a picture. Then there is a whole series of healings, either sickness or blindness. There's lots of, in fact, there's one place that says that he did many other signs. I picked one that you've probably heard if you went to Sunday school, and if you're old enough, you saw the little flannel graphs. And the teacher had put all the little people up there. And the one I remember, or one of them, is the healing of the paralytic. Thank you. It's interesting when you look at that story, because we're going to add another dimension to what's going on. Here you have four men that has a friend. They're going to take him to Jesus because they believe Jesus can heal him. They can't get there. The building's full. So they go to the roof. And when you look at that, as a little kid, I always pictured my house with the roof, and they're tearing it apart. And I go, that's not a good thing. But their houses had a flat roof. They used it for a lot of things. They may have a party up there. They may sleep up there. They may do their sorting of their vegetables and everything up there. It was a part of their house. The bottom floor is full. So these four guys, they go to the top, remove the tiles, and they let their friend down through the roof to Jesus. Everybody remember that? See the little flannel graphs? Here's what makes it different. When the man gets to Jesus on his pallet, Jesus doesn't heal him right away. Instead, he says, your sins are forgiven. That shocked a lot of the people, especially the scribes and the Pharisees. And they're thinking in their mind, Only God can forgive sin. And Jesus knew what they were thinking. And he says, which is easier? To say your sins are forgiven, or to tell this man to get up, roll up his bed, and go home. And then he tells the man, get up and go home. And he does. What do you think? Who is this man? Now they're not only saying that can heal, that says he can forgive sin. Who is he? And you see that dimension now added to what's going on. The next group of miracles that I want to look at is he raises the dead. And there are several of those that take place. But when you look at Jairus, one of the elders of the synagogue in Capernaum, he's come to Jesus and said, my daughter is sick. She's going to die. Can you come? And Jesus says, yeah, I'll come. On the way, another miracle takes place, though. You have a woman that's been hemorrhaging for 12 years. The doctors can't help her. And she believes that if she could just touch Jesus, she would be healed. And that's what happens. And Jesus stops and says, who touched me? Well, the disciples look around and say, we're in a crowd. What do you mean? And the woman comes forward and says, and tells her story. And Jesus says, your faith has made you well. And then he goes on to Jairus' place. But on the way, they said, don't bother him anymore. His servants say, she's already died. Jesus goes anyway, and he takes Peter, James, and John with him. The rest of them don't go. And they get there, and here's all the chaos going on. You've got the mourners out there. That was a part of their tradition. There's crying and weeping. And Jesus said, go home. She's not dead. She's just asleep. And they laugh. That tells you that they're paid mourners because they could switch from mourning to laughing. That was their job. They knew when a person was dead. And Jesus just said, she's not dead. And he goes in, takes her by the hand, and she gets up. And then he says, she's hungry, go feed her. Who is this man that can raise the dead? As we work through and there's several examples like that, of that type of healing. You have a man by the name of Cornelius that amazes Jesus. Because centurion, who comes and says, he has a servant that's ill. And Jesus says, I'll go. And the centurion says, you don't have to go. I command soldiers. I tell them what to do and they go do it. All you have to do is say the word. This guy's a Gentile. And Jesus is amazed at his faith. Who is this man that's even influencing now the Gentile world? Who is he? At this point, we go back to the rest of this text here out of Mark. Who do you say I am? And Peter, who's really probably speaking for all of the disciples at this point, I can see them shaking their head when he says, you are the Christ. At that point, we see a shift. And Jesus begins to explain to them that he's going to die. They get it, kind of. They still aren't so sure about part of this, because Peter will later take him aside and said, that's not the way it should be. You're not going to die. And God says, get behind me, Satan. That's not the plan. We move on down to Bethany next. In Bethany, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus live. And they send word to Jesus saying that Lazarus is sick. You know, would you come and heal him? Jesus doesn't. He waits around a few more days. In fact, the disciples aren't so sure they even want to go back to Jerusalem, because they know Jesus is talking about dying. And finally, one of the disciples will say, well, let's all go down with him and die together. It's kind of an interesting statement. But he waits. Jesus waits until Lazarus is dead. Then he goes to Bethany. And on the way down, before they get to the village, Martha meets him and says, if you'd been here, Lazarus wouldn't have died. True enough, Mary comes, the same kind of scenario, and she weeps. Jesus weeps. Then he says, take me to the tomb. And so everybody goes. They're all going to go down and mourn together at the tomb. But that's not Jesus' plan. When he gets to the tomb, what's he tell them to do? Remove the stone. What do they say? He's been in there 4 days. He stinks. And what does Jesus do? He commands Lazarus to come forth. Come out. And he comes out all wrapped up in his funeral garb. And at that point, part of the crowd believe. Another part of the crowd, though, go to the chief priest and then tell them what's going on. And that's the third group. You've got those who love him, those who fear him, and you have those who hate him. And that from that point forward, they plot to kill Jesus. But our question is, who is he? Well, we always have to finish the story, I guess. Out of the 12, there's one disciple that betrays Jesus. John calls him a thief. He betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And I guess the question is, because remember, Judas has been with Jesus. He's seen all of the miracles. He's heard the teachings. The question has been asked. And yet, he basically rejects that and betrays Jesus. The high priests, or the priests and the Pharisees, they've heard that message too. They've rejected it. Who is Jesus? That's the question that all of us have to answer. Do you reject Jesus, or do you accept him? That's the question. And then we know Jesus goes to the cross. And he dies for our sin. He takes our place. That was his plan from the beginning. To take our place. Pay our debt. But that's not the last miracle. After he's dead and buried, 3 days later, what does he do? He rises from the dead, or raises from the dead. Probably the greatest of the miracles. Who is this man? He can control the natural world. He can command demons to leave. He can heal the sick. He can forgive your sin. He dies in your place. And then he rises again. Quite a picture. Now, we have another disciple we need to look at. We have Thomas. Thomas believed. The disciples, they've all fled at one point out of fear. Peter's even denied Jesus. But they've all got back together after the resurrection, except Thomas. Thomas, when the other disciples tell him he's alive, he says, I don't believe it until I can see with my own eyes, touch him with my own hands. Well, they're all together and Thomas is with him. With them. And it says Jesus came through the door. He didn't open the door. He comes in to the room. And Jesus addresses Thomas. And he says, here, touch my hands. Put your hand in my side. You don't find Thomas doing that. It doesn't say that he touched them at all. What he does is he says, my Lord and my God. That's the contrast. You have one disciple that refuses Jesus. You have one disciple that declares he's Lord and God. And Lord means, another word you could use, is master. He's declaring that from now on, he will follow Jesus. That's the difference. And that is the message that we need to tell the world. Who is Jesus? Find out who they think he is. And then explain to them who he is. You'll know where to start. For the most of you here, you've already accepted Christ as Lord and Savior. If you haven't, the invitation is always here. For all of us, I want you to commit yourself to telling others who Jesus is. Let's go ahead and sing our last song.